my name's Tamsin Westall and welcome to Fresh from the Pod Gardening Stories. It's Christmas, we all need a treat, so I thought, who can we have on Fresh from the Pod that will add that festive sparkle? Well, it had to be Alan Titchmarsh. He needs absolutely no introduction, but just in case you've been hiding under a rock for years, he is our much-cherished gardening TV presenter, writer, and most importantly, hands-on gardener. I hope you enjoy this Christmas treat. Well, Alan, I'm thrilled that you've come as a guest on Fresh from the Pod. You have not put your feet up during this lockdown, have you? You've not only just won an award for Garden Columnists of the Year with the Garden Media Guild, you've campaigned the government to keep our garden centres open, and you've got a new TV show.
It's been a busy time. I've been very lucky. I mean, you know, a lot of people that I know have just had to stand down from telly, particularly writers. We're very lucky when we write because we don't need anything except a laptop or a typewriter, if you're old-fashioned, or a pen or a quill. So, you know, you can stay at home, you can do the writing, but the sociability, of course, is what you miss. And I've been really lucky with the television that I've been doing because the first one, Grow Your Own at Home, happened during lockdown, that first lockdown.
Yes.
And being regarded as old and vulnerable, because I'm over a certain age, it meant that only Alison and I could occupy our garden. So they said, well, never mind, Alison can film it on her iPhone. Now, my wife has never taken a snap on her iPhone. And then they said, well, actually, it won't really be compatible if it's on an iPhone. We're going to send you a camera. To cut a very long story short, Alison, bless her, learnt how to use this camera, became an ace camera woman, and we did. Originally, they said just 3 weeks of Grow Your Own at Home. Then it went down so well, so they wanted six.
Oh.
So my wife and I would saunter out into the garden, admittedly in pretty nice weather, though the first week it was very hot, very sunny, and very windy, which made life a bit challenging. But we did it. And so, yes, we were occupied during that. Then things slackened off a bit. We were able to do a programme, not Alison and me, but me and ITV, a programme we've been planning to start filming in April called Love Your Weekend, which
yes.
is a Sunday mornings for 2 hours on ITV, sort of predicated on the countryside and gardening with a few celebrity guests sprinkled through. We couldn't start that until July, but now we're underway and we're running now. Again, that's been successful, bless it. So we're running until the 7th of March at the moment.
Gosh, well, I've been watching that, not every week, but your first episode, I was so excited because you had my all-time crush as a guest, which was Jason Donovan. I thought,
yes.
Well done, Alan. Wow.
It's a great combination, wasn't it? Jason Donovan and Craig Revel Hall.
Yeah.
But we've had some great guests. I think what people like about it, I mean, as I say, we look at sheep, llamas, ducks, I'm doing this week, all kinds of livestock and wildflowers and trees, but with celebrity guests. Inserted, as it were, just for a bit of leavening, but talking to them about countryside as well. Cliff Richards on the show. We had David Jason last week. More people coming. It's just lovely that people want to come on. And I think it's because it's not rushed. We're doing interviews yeah. that are sort of 10 and 12 minutes long, which is quite unusual. But it is a delight to do. It's sort of everything I do, which is interviewing and talking to people, but also based in and on the countryside.
Yeah, in a lovely environment. But I was trying to sort of pin down in my mind, why do we all love watching Alan on TV? And I think what it is that you don't go out there to shock or upset or, you know, you're very calm. When I turn the telly on and you're there, I think, oh, good, we're not going to have any tears. We're not going to have a Piers Morgan breakdown. You ask sort of polite and people just feel instantly comfortable. Is that a style that you've worked on or is that just you? Is it taking a while to get that technique?
Well, it's the danger, of course, is then it becomes dull and boring and predictable. So, you know, you worry on that score, but it's known in the business. In fact, my agent was talking to me yesterday and she said, I know what you like and what you don't like. And I've been on the telly now for over 40 years and I started radio in 77, so a long time. I don't like confrontation.
No.
It's known that I won't work with directors who shout because it unsettles me, it unsettles guests. And I've always maintained with guests, it's rather like going in a river. You catch more trout by tickling than you do by wading in with a club. And sometimes watching the likes of Jeremy Paxman can be entertaining. But a lot of the time, I find myself getting uncomfortable. And I just want a good conversation out of the guest, really. I mean, this, in a way, you talk to me, is my least favourite occupation. That all I do is hear myself droning on. I'd far rather be asking the questions than wittering on. And I just want to ask the questions that the person watching at home will want to ask. And it's up to me, I think. My style is just to create an environment in which my guests are comfortable and the viewer at home is comfortable. I like what I call gosh factor. It's very nice if they're eating their scrambled egg on toast when they're watching it. It's very nice if you can make them stop with the fork halfway to their mouth because you, oh, you know, so I want to be interesting and interested, but just not either bad-tempered or confrontational. Yeah, but I hope that it's nevertheless interesting all the same.
Oh, absolutely. But when you've got a guest, someone like David Jason, in front of you, do you do a tremendous amount of research? Do you feel you need to, or are you at a point where you just relax into it and you start chatting easily?
I bone up either the night before or very early in the morning when I'm doing an interview, but it's generally just to sort of start your mind cooking a bit, really. I tend to know all my guests, or know of my guests, and know what they've done. So that's all there. And I have little cards, and I just write several words down as little triggers. I don't write questions out, and I don't structure an interview. I just jot down areas that I'm keen to cover. But you've got to be flexible in an interview. You have to go with it. You know, the jokey line has always been that, you know, you've got 10 questions, and you're on question 5, and then they say, and that was the day that I killed my wife. And then question 6 is, and what colour is your bathroom? You know, you've got to be ready to pick up. And then it's a conversation, and you can follow up things. And I just, yes, it is natural. I like to have a relaxed interview, but hopefully not one which is soporific.
Yeah, but your background as a journalist, I love telling people that I had your old job after you, because you worked for Amateur Gardening magazine, didn't you?
I did. I joined as assistant editor and became deputy editor, yeah.
Yeah, so that's exactly what happened to me. So I always used to say to people, oh, I've got Alan's old job. Obviously haven't done quite as well as him. But
I think you've done all right. Did you get that lovely desk? It was a lovely mahogany desk that used to be sat behind by T.H. Sanders, who wrote Sanders' Encyclopedia of Gardening. And the deputy editor of Amateur Gardening had this lovely mahogany desk with a brass plaque on it. And I always felt I had to live up to Sanders' reputation.
No, I definitely didn't have the desk. It was in the office, though. It was more of a reception desk. It had been upgraded. But what made you move from, you know, being a parks gardener and a hands-on gardener to being a journalist? Because I think you're like me. You didn't go and do a degree in journalism. What was the move for? Why did you feel inspired?
Well, because I've always liked words, I think. I left school early. I left school at 15 with one O-level in art because I just wanted to be a gardener. And I went to the Parks Department nursery and did my apprenticeship. Then I went to college. And then I was lucky enough to get on the student's course to do the diploma at Kew Gardens. That was 3 years. And then I stayed on there for 2 years as supervisor of staff training because I was convinced I wanted to teach. And that was a way of teaching. It was teaching basic horticultural skills and bits of science and everything to the gardeners at Kew. But after 2 years of that and setting up the courses and structuring them, I realised that there were two things about it that I found difficult. One is that I had to do the same thing every year. And the second was that although I wanted to teach, not everybody wanted to learn. And it's very hard when you're... My wife and at least one of my daughters have both been teachers. And they tell me I'm very patient with plants, but less patient with people who are not wanting to learn. So anyway, I'd been there sort of 5 years altogether at Kew, and my boss came in one day and said, who do we know with a literary bent? And I said, me, because I just always loved words and I've always been a letter writer and I'm a fountain pen user, you know, so I've always written for fun at school. And I applied to Hamlin's as a gardening books editor. A couple of years there, and then I wanted a bit more faster pace of life. So that's when I applied to Amateur Gardening and got in there. Then they moved to Dorset. I'd started doing a bit of radio about gardening. And so I took the plunge, went freelance, and there we are. I'm now officially unemployable, I think.
But I mean, when you were at Amateur Gardening, they were probably still using sort of marking things out and paper and light boxes. And it's a totally different world now. What you've seen and I've seen in my journalism career, the techniques of actually creating a publication is miles and worlds away from what we started out doing, isn't it?
Well, when I left Amateur Gardening in 1979, I still wrote for them, and I had a little shed that I put up in the garden, and I had a typewriter, clack, clack, clack. I've still got it, you know, a black and chrome typewriter, and I would type my column with a carbon copy, if you remember what they were, and a bottle of Tippex to hand, and I would put the top copy in a buff envelope with a first-class stamp on it, keep the carbon as my copy, and post it every week. And that was my first copy. I then got an electric typewriter. I then got an electronic typewriter. Then I had a bit of a screen, and then, and here we are now, and I write on a laptop, you know. What a change.
Quite incredible. I remember when I went off to have my son 15 years ago, and I came back to Amateur Gardening, and they were talking about using digital photography, and I was, this will never work, this is absolutely outrageous. Of course it will work. I mean, we're all, it's, you've just got to go with it, haven't you? And you really
have
with things, you've moved with the times, haven't you?
Well, it's exciting. I mean, I'm not, IT doesn't fascinate me much at all, but what, the way in which it makes my job easier, and particularly with laptops and iPads that you can edit on, that's been the greatest revelation to a writer, is that you can take that paragraph out and put it in lower down without having to either cut a piece of paper up or paint it looking as though it's been emulsioned with Tippex to change it all around. So that kind of technology, I love the technology that I know how to use and that is useful to me. But, you know, when I started Amateur Gardening, we were still using black and white photographs for some pages. And the colour was transparencies that you had to put on a light box. And I vividly remember a fax coming in and, like you, thinking, well, this will never last.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, it didn't last. It was superseded.
But do you know what's so funny is we had all these cabinets with pictures in. And when I arrived, we'd root through them looking for transparencies. And there was pictures of you, you know, from, in lovely flared trousers and things. And when I left, I begged the girls on the desk, please, can you throw away the early images of me, because I had terrible buck teeth and I hadn't had my teeth fixed, and they were so lovely. I remember they'd say, we promise we'll cut them up, Tamsin. So I got them to get rid of me with my buck teeth. But you don't sort of think at the time, you know, images of you back then, I mean, they're fascinating to us now, aren't they, seeing the Alan Titchmarsh of yesteryear.
Well, yeah, because the problem is when you're in the job where you are in the public eye and where images are taken of you, most people have got a few in a scrapbook at home or a photo album. You know, but those of us who are on the box, you're there all the time. You can see yourself age. They'll show a clip of you, you know. I didn't go grey till I was about 65. But now, of course, there's grey hair in here. And I look back and it's a little 4 or 5 years ago where, I was quite dark then, wasn't I? You know, but hey, if you live your life in the public eye, you've just got to grit your teeth.
You've got to go with it.
You know. Yeah.
But my sort of memories of working for a gardening magazine, I went to move on to a monthly then, and this was when you were doing Ground Force. So it was 1997 to 2005, which was when I was sort of doing makeovers in magazines. It was unbelievable the impact that that show had, wasn't it? I mean, did you ever imagine that it would just turn into such a popular show?
Not a clue. I mean, when I was asked to do it, they very kindly said they were looking for a vehicle for me, which was very nice. I said, well, I've got a reasonable car already. They said, no, that's sort of vehicle. And I remember I was in the Metropole Hotel in Birmingham, because it was Gardeners World Live, and this producer said to me, I'll meet up with you, I've got an idea for a program. We met up there and he said, we've got this idea to do a garden makeover. And I said, no, you have gardens take years.
It won't work. Yeah.
You can't possibly do that. So he said, you couldn't achieve anything in 2 days then. So the gauntlet was thrown down. You know, I said, well, I wouldn't say you couldn't achieve anything. But, you know, it's a, anyway, it became ground force. None of us had any idea that it was going to be such a hit. I mean, it started on BBC Two, and they moved us off BBC Two because we were, quotes, too popular. So we went on to BBC One, and I vividly remember there was a repeat went out one Good Friday, and it got 12 million viewers.
Oh, gosh.
Just astonishing. And it was the Bake Off of its day. It was quite astonishing. But the thing is, we were very assiduous in making the garden properly, in planting things properly. And, you know, it had its detractors, oh, these makeover programs. Well, gardening is a makeover. You are making over a piece of land. And if you're doing it in 2 days, you can achieve quite a lot on a small patch of ground, which hasn't got anything in it. You know, you and I both know that you plant a tree, you plant perennials underneath, you might plant them a bit closer. Of course you can do something. And then you offer it up for adoption to the people that you've made it for. And you can make a difference. And what it did, that programme, was got a lot of people into gardening who would find Gardener's World intimidating. And I say that as the man who at that time was presenting Gardener's World as well. So I had my programme on a Friday night for the people who were quite keen gardeners. But then Ground Force introduced a lot of people who'd never dare really go out there and do anything because it was all a bit scary. So, yeah, I did, I think, about 67 gardens altogether.
I mean, physically, watching you, Charlie, and Tommy, physically, that was quite intense, wasn't it, to get that done?
It was intense, and it's still intense now. You know, Love Your Garden, which is on ITV now, is a similar kind of programme. It's still a makeover programme. We do it on Love Your Garden, though, for people whose lives will really be turned round, who really deserve it. Either they're infirm or they have, you know, particularly domestic circumstances where they've not been able to do it. And we've done it for, you know, servicemen who've lost limbs. We've done it for older people who have mobility issues, giving them a space that they couldn't utilise before. And it does change lives. You know, the letters we get and the little bits of film at the end of Love Your Garden, which show them having used it. And you see weight lifting from shoulders of people who've been confined to a house. I remember we did one for a couple who were both in wheelchairs. They had two young children. They were both wheelchair-bound, their parents. This was, we've done one or two called Love Your Home and Garden, where we've actually changed the downstairs in the house as well. They'd never been able to get out into their garden, and it was too dangerous for the children. So we opened up the back wall with bifold doors and did the garden, and they loved it. But the loveliest thing of all, in a way, was a lady who emailed me and said, I live in the street where you made this garden. Whenever I used to walk past this garden, it was silent. She said, and now whenever I walk past this garden, all I hear is the sound of laughter. And I thought, that's why we do it.
Yeah. And I think during this very strange time, fortunately, people have grabbed hold of gardening. They've really realised, haven't they, the impact it can make on their lives and what a valuable space it is.
But thank goodness the garden centres did open.
Yeah.
You're right, I was campaigning to get, because not only for the horticulture industry, which is, you know, people forget it's worth $24 billion to the UK economy. Fishing is worth $1.4 Horticulture, $24 billion. It just puts it into perspective. But also, it's not just the economy, it's people's mental health. You know, we desperately needed, the only place we could go during that first lockdown was the garden, our own gardens, if we had a bit. And not to be able to do anything in it or plant anything in it. At the time in May, when that's the big planting season, it's also the time that growers are supplying all these plants to garden centres, be they annuals or perennials or trees and shrubs. To have not opened them there would have been disastrous, both for the individual at home and for the horticulture industry. So I'm quite cautious about putting my head above the parapet. I don't want to be that guy who's always moaning or going on about something. But I thought, no, this is something I really want to stand up for. And all credit to him, I emailed Michael Gove directly, and he replied within 20 minutes. And I thought that was pretty impressive. And the fact that we did get them open, I was really relieved about, I think. That was,
yeah.
It was very important. And they've been a salvation. They've been a saviour of so many lives this year, gardens. And yes, you're right. I mean, I know Gardeners World magazine has had more readers than it's ever had. The garden centres, of their attendance footfall has gone up by, I don't know how many percent, an awful lot. So yes, they've been used. Our gardens have suddenly being valued for what they are, which is this amazing place in which to relax, grow your own food, feel at one with nature, all those really important things that you and I have known for years, but it's rubbing off.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you just hope that these people carry on gardening. I mean, I'm sure we're all realists that many people will head off on their normal annual holiday next year and they won't be as interested. But there's got to, it's got to have made a difference, hasn't it? It's got to have caught some people.
If you've made a good friend, you tend not to drop them. You tend not to forget that they're a good friend. And you know, you may not see them for a while, but you'll remember them fondly. I hope the garden in a way is like that. People will remember what the garden did for them during that first lockdown in particular. And they'll realise that their lives were improved by being out there, by being among plants, by feeding the birds, by encouraging butterflies. You know, it's very important that we garden not just organically, but sensitively and sustainably for the environment. And I hope people realise that that is, it's a pleasure and a delight, not an onerous chore, to garden in such a way that that piece of earth is improved and you're doing your bit for the environment. The next generation coming along now, the young kids coming along, are very environmentally conscious, and I want them to have more to nail their colours to, really, rather than just global warming and climate change. That's very important, but they need to be aware of the hands-on delights of that piece of earth outside their back door. It's very easy, particularly when watching the news, to feel overwhelmed by the universality of it all, the scale and size of it, and think, I can't possibly make a difference to that. But in that little bit outside your back door, that's very, very important. That makes a difference to the wildlife on your doorstep, literally. And everybody should do that. And those who carry banners around complaining about this, that, and the other should really, you know, I'm not against that at all, but I do think that it's up to us as individuals, as well as governments, which I've lobbied, as you know, to us individuals to make sure that little bit outside our back door is in good order. Look after the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves.
Yeah. And from a sort of mental health point of view, the number of people I know that have just found such comfort by being in nature, being outside, getting your hands dirty. And I think that there's a lot more that horticulture can do, create more opportunities for people to get their hands dirty if they haven't got a garden. So that's quite exciting that it's proven, hasn't it, now, really, that it is so good.
I think also the more young ambassadors we can get for it, you know, I'm you know, regarded as an, you know, probably now as an old fart, really, compared with... But if we get 20-somethings doing it, you know, cool 20-something, and there are, I mean, people like Frances Topple and Katie Rushworth, who garden on Love Your Garden, they're young, you know, they're in their 30s, 20s and 30s. And to see people like that who understand what gardening is doing, they are the ambassadors for this next generation. And I think that's tremendous. We've got to, you know, I'm lucky enough, you're very kind at the Garden Media Guild, the Alan Titchmarsh Young Talent Award or New Talent Award, those are the people whose job it is now to enthuse not only this next generation but the one after that as well, to show what delight we get out of it. And it's not just something for old men with a cloth cap and, you know, a pipe. This is something for all of us, and it's vital and vitally important.
Now, I want to take you back to Ground Force, because something I can't not ask you about is creating a garden for Nelson Mandela. I mean, that has got to be up there, hasn't it?
It is pretty much up there. I do have a photograph in our sitting room of me and Nelson laughing together. I'm a great collector of photographs of me laughing with people. I've got one of me laughing with the Queen, which is quite nice. And I've got one of me laughing with Nelson Mandela too. He was an amazing man. I mean, I can remember, you know, almost every single thing about that trip to South Africa, to going to Robben Island where he was imprisoned and being given the key to his cell and being allowed to let myself into it and walking in there and seeing this little grey box, grey gloss paint box with a tiny window high up and a bucket and a blanket in the corner. That's all he had. And then we made the garden for him, and he came back on time. I said, could you get him back, please, at 5 o'clock? We have 3 days to do Nelson rather than two. Oh. Could we get him back at 5 o'clock on day three? And they said, well, actually, is President Clinton in the States at the moment? We'll try and get him back that day. So, and I suddenly realised...
What you were asking.
My relative importance in the scale of things. Anyway, he turned up at 5 o'clock on day three, the motorcade. This is in Kunu, in the Transkei, which is his country home, where he was from, where his tribe was from. There was one funny thing that happened. And that is that the head of his tribe out there was called Mrs. Balizulu. And Mrs. Balizulu was a large lady who didn't speak English. She had on, I remember, a big black skirt, a pure white blouse, and a black leather trilby. And cool. She came up to the garden, and they came and they brought Mrs. Balizulu into the garden. And somebody from the local came up to me and said, this is very... worrying. So I said, what? They said, you haven't asked Mrs. Balizulu's permission to be here. And I said, oh gosh. And they said, yes, you always have to go to the head of the tribe first and then you can start doing what you're doing. So I thought, oh crumbs. And they said, you better talk to her now. So I had to talk to her through an interpreter. And so I explained to Mrs. Balizulu what we were doing. And then she nodded in the end and she said something which I didn't understand.
Probably get them out of here.
Well, no. He said, Mrs. Balizulu says, it is all right. Now you will not be killed. So that was all right. So, yes, I wish I should have done it before. Anyway, we did it. And Mr. Mandela came back and was absolutely charming. And I sat down and with him and interviewed him for half an hour, which, as far as the British press were concerned, was absolutely appalling, because all these important interviewers had been trying to get an interview with Nelson Mandela for years. This is 20 years ago now, it's 2000. And there's this upstart gardener who sat down and did a half-hour interview with him. But he was lovely, because he said, you must realise, he said, how important plants are to me. Because he said, when I was imprisoned on Robben Island, the only thing I had any control over was two tomato plants, which I grew in the corner of the prison yard. Gosh. And one day I noticed one of them was getting a bit sickly. And he said, I tried everything to revive it. I gave it more water, less water, shook its roots, whatever. But it just died. He said, I dug it up and I took it over to the other side of the prison yard and I buried it. I gave it a burial.
Aww.
He said, and that will show you how important growing things was to me. And he said, I will look after this garden as long as I can. And we'd taken with us various things. We'd see if we could get them signed. And we were told before he came back, look, Mr. Mandela doesn't sign things anymore. He's signed far too many things. So don't ask him to sign anything. So we thought, well, fair enough. That's all right. He's been very busy. And we got to the end and we'd done the garden. He made us tea and gave us tea and buns. And then he said, if you want anything signing, I'd be delighted to do it. So I'd take my copy of Long Walk to Freedom with me. So I gave him my copy of Long Walk to Freedom, and I treasure it now because he wrote in it, to Alan, a competent and caring journalist, sincerely, N. Mandela. So when anybody tells me I'm incompetent,
you look at
I can
that.
Say, yeah, Nelson Mandela said I was competent. I think he meant it kindly rather than barely competent. Yeah. It was very, very special, amazing man. He had an enormous quiet grace. The best way I can describe it. Enormously charismatic, but in a very quiet way. Wonderful man.
What an experience. But you know, it reminds me, this is totally on a different level, obviously. When I was about 16, so this is in about 1988, I worked at Burford House Gardens in Tenbury Wells, where my uncle John Treasure gardened. And you came, I don't know what it was for, to do a TV show. And they said, Alan Titchmarsh is coming. And I just started and they said, we want you to be on the till. And you have to pretend to serve him. I have never been so frightened in my life. I'd never used the till. I was a new girl. And then suddenly I'm there. I remember it so well. You probably don't remember it, but...
I'm very flattered. Yeah. And I do remember it because it's the first and only time I met John Treasure, and he gave me some seeds of a wonderful little white annual Omphalodes, which I sowed under a birch tree. And I've never forgotten that Omphalodes, really kind of, because he was a, you know, he was one of those legendary names, John Treasure.
Oh, do you know?
Gardener.
Absolutely love it. And they didn't know what to do with me because a little like you, I failed at school. And so they sent me to work with him, my family. So go and work with John. I wanted to be a gardener. And gosh, I learnt from him. And he was really quite strict. You know, it was a really good grounding for me in you know, proper horticulture. But yeah, I won't forget that. But I suddenly had to step up and be, this freaked out teenager.
As long as you gave me the correct change, Tamsin, that's all.
Yeah, well, I can't vouch for that. I can't remember. Now, someone else that you've interviewed is obviously Prince Charles. You did a tour of Highgrove with him. Gosh, that was, when was that? That was quite a while ago, 2011 or something around that time. How do you prepare for something like that?
I think it's the same with whoever you're going to interview. The most important thing is not to be overawed. I mean, to do your job well, whether it's Nelson Mandela, the Prince of Wales, or the man who sweeps your chimney. You need to know a bit of background. You need to know, you know, how he got into gardening, that kind of thing. But I've met him quite a lot over the years. We first met in the mid-80s, 1985, I think, when I designed a couple of gardens for Barrett Homes in Bracknell. And they were homes for the disabled, and he was coming to open them. And I've still got a photograph of us meeting for the first time. We both had a lot more dark hair and wearing suits which had wider trousers. And I first met him there. So we'd sort of encountered one another over the years quite a bit. And I see him every now and again now. I think really just knowing what people do, and I'm a great believer in the magic of the moment. If I go along to interview somebody, I do my homework, but I don't want to over prepare because it can make it become stagnant and lifeless. Yeah. And so sort of keeping yourself on your toes is, I don't mean nerves. I've always been very lucky in doing TV. If I am a bit apprehensive and there are one or two butterflies in my tummy, they've never come out in my hands. And I think when you're wielding a sharp knife taking cuttings, it's just as well. Otherwise, there'd be blood everywhere.
Yeah.
So I've always been very lucky. And I always get a little lift before I broadcast. Not nervousness, but just performance lift, you know, because it keeps you sharp. And it's the Prince of Wales over the years, I mean, he said it, so I can say now, has become a good friend, and I'm very fond of him. So now it's as exciting as it is when you meet a friend that you haven't seen for a while. So we do know one another now. He teases me, and I tease him a bit sometimes. But he's brought to the role an amazing amount of talent and riches. I get very angry when people only judge him on his, you know, on a marriage which didn't work out terribly well, and that's the thing that's most often trumpeted. If we all judged our friends on marriages that didn't turn out very well, we wouldn't have many friends, would we? I've always found him a really, he's extraordinarily good company. He's very well informed. He's got a great sense of humour, great generosity of spirit, and I enjoy being with him. And I think that's the thing, really. And he's, what he's done for horticulture and gardening and the landscape and the Prince's Trust and the Prince's Countryside Fund, both of which I'm an ambassador for, is great. You know, I mean, he didn't have to do all those things. And he's taken the knocks over the years, you know.
I went to a dinner at St. James's Palace, and one of those things, how have I ended up here, but I've got to go. And we were all sort of milling around the room, and we were told, you know, just relax, the Prince of Wales is coming in. And I could not believe how he'd obviously, he knew who we all were. I mean, he worked a room that I've never, ever seen. And he said, hello, how's the magazine world? And I just thought, this is unbelievable. And then moved on to the next person. The level of interest he obviously had in us all, because we were all sort of in horticulture or crafts, and it was for the Prince's Trust. I just thought, well, that is, it's a skill, isn't it? Absolutely.
It is. What's wonderful, Tamsin, is when you're with somebody, and it's happened over the years once or twice that I've been with somebody who hasn't particularly not particularly a royalist or hasn't particularly rated him and a bit kind of, and I've been standing next to them when he has, as you say, worked the room or come around, or, you know, when the Queen has or whatever. And what is so interesting is to see the transformation of opinion. Once somebody's met him or talked to him or been engaged by him, it completely changes their view and they say, well, he's amazing, isn't he? Yeah, very much as you said. Now, I mean, yes, he's obviously done his homework, but good for him, you know.
Exactly.
And he is interested, and
But do you find, would you some days want to wake up and think, I don't want to be Alan Titchmarsh anymore. I want to just walk down to the garden centre or walk round a garden show and nobody judge me? Because obviously every time they see you, oh, you know, he looked like he was in a hurry or whatever. You know, does that, does that exhaust you? Does it absolutely exhaust you or not?
I think it is the old thing about if you don't like the heat, keep out of the kitchen. Most of my local garden centres are very kind. They let me go round before they open. Yeah. And sometimes I can't. Sometimes I need something in the, you know, middle of the afternoon or something, and I will go. And I'll just sort of, what do I say, get my head down. I don't wear dark glasses and a baseball cap or anything like that. Many years ago, I did try that one. I was walking down the high street. Somebody said, hello, Alan, you're trying not to be recognised.
Brilliant.
I just get on with my life. I don't make. I know one or two people in show business who make kind of royal progress down the street. And they're
yes.
Like, morning, hello, hello. You know, I get on. If people say hello, I'll say hello back. You know, that's fine. But I've been me for a long time now, and I'm the only person I know like that. So you get on. But there are days when you just want to be quiet. But that's why gardening's so lovely. You see, I can stay in my own garden and potter here or go to my children's gardens and be with them. And I don't have a starry life in terms of the way I carry myself out. I mean, I realise that a lot of people will know I am. So it's important not to let them down, really. I've always felt that you should, you know, but then I was brought up to be good-mannered regardless of what I did by my parents. So it doesn't matter that I'm on the telly. It doesn't make me behave any differently.
Now, you also presented Songs of Praise. And as this is going out at Christmas, are you a man that really celebrates Christmas? Do you have a big faith? And is it an important time of year for you?
It is. And I do. And it's very quiet. And I'm not a tub thumper.
Yeah.
But it's been part of my life since I was. I mean, I was. My parents. My dad was a bell ringer and sang in the choir. My mum ran the Brownies and the Mothers' Union, which of course can make you completely turn away.
Yes.
And in my late teens and early 20s, I sort of parked it for a bit. But it's been. It's a part of who I am, and I do have a faith, and it's quite. It's very deep, but it's not evangelical in any way. I'm a classic low churchman. I don't go every Sunday. I do say my prayers, but it's. I don't want to put other people off thinking you're holier than thou, you know. But it's very important to me, and Christmas is important, not least because of family. But I do remember what Christmas is about, I tend to have a very large. I've got a library that I collect books, and I've got a very old Bible, and I open that at the Gospel pages during the run up to Christmas, and so the Christmas story is told by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You know, and I have it open at a particular piece, and I opened it yesterday because it's the 1st of December today, and it's Advent Sunday. Yesterday, and so I opened it at the Annunciation, you know, with Gabriel talking to Mary. But I it's a most wonderful story. It's my faith is rooted in it. But I wouldn't want people to think, oh, we can't talk to him. He's a God botherer, you know. And I suppose that's always concerned me a little. But whenever I'm asked that, if I am a Christian, I do have faith, I'd say, yes, I am. You know, I'll stand up and be counted, but quietly.
Yeah,
it's important to me, but it's up to each individual to decide what's important to them. And I approach Songs of Praise like every man. I wanted to talk to other people from the standpoint of just a person saying, so what do you get out of it? Why do you do it? Rather than going, I'm not a vicar. you know.
Mm. Well, I was in the choir. We have a village church, which is a big part of our lives. My mother's the church warden. And for me, it's just those lovely, happy memories. We all used to, there was quite a lot of us in the choir when I was sort of 12, and we would roll gobstoppers along the pew. And it's just really, really, we had a lovely time. But what will Christmas Day hold for you this year? Do you have a big lunch, or are you an evening meal?
Well, I'm hoping we'll be together. I've got two daughters and they've each got two small children. One's got two little boys, one's got two little girls. Oh. So we are hoping that with the Christmas dispensation that we can be together at least for Christmas dinner, which tends to be lunch. It tends to be about 2 o'clock. Otherwise, Alison says, you know, if you're doing it in the evening, you're spending all day cooking. So we tend to have a lunch. But this year, I think my younger daughter's hosting us. They both my girls live quite close to us, which is lovely. So we tend to see each other most days of the week, which is absolutely lovely. But to be with the grandchildren is very special at Christmas, and it is a family time. We normally, most Christmases, we've got a large room. I write in this barn that I'm sitting in now, and just behind me there's a large room where we have it's a little theatre that we made in this barn, and we tend to do a Christmas entertainment there most years, but not this year, of course. So next year we'll be back with a vengeance. I tend to write things that, well, as you know, I write poetry as well, so I've written quite a lot of Christmas poems over the years, and we use those, and we sing a few carols, and we do some funny sketches, so funny or touching or both. But Christmas, yeah, very special time of year for friends and family.
And that's how you met your wife, wasn't it? Through amateur dramatics. Am I right?
It was. She was a dancer, and I was I sort of comeded a bit and acted a bit. So, yeah, we met in half a sixpence in, 1975, 48 years ago.
Gosh.
Been married for 45.
And I met your wife at a dinner we had together at Raymond Blanc's hotel many moons ago. And she's obviously been a huge support to you. You know, is she helpful sort of on a practical level, or does she sort of boost you? What's been her role in your career?
We have a little cushion in our bathroom which says, behind every successful man lies an exhausted woman.
Yeah.
She's been enormously supportive. She doesn't garden, but we always joke that she has a queenly role to advise and to warn. And I said, oh, I quite fancy putting something. Really? All right. So I talk it through all the time with her. She's always the first one to read my novels when I start writing them. She reads them and says, is that going to happen, or is that? So, yeah, I mean, just the most amazing support. And a great mum, great, you know, wife, and yeah, long time now we've been together, but I think we quite like one another. It's quite handy if you
that
quite
helps.
Like somebody.
Yeah, it does help. So what's left for you? I know you're probably a man with lots of things you'd like to do, but is there something that you think, I really, really want to achieve that in my career?
I don't really have anything else, Tamsin. I've been so lucky. I mean, to do what I've done, from everything from riding with the King's Troop Royal Horse Artillery to flying a Spitfire to presenting the last night of the proms to making a garden for Nelson Mandela. I mean, how dare he, really? And I did a stint on the West End stage in Wind in the Willows for the Royal Ballet, which was wonderful, playing Kenneth Graham. I mean, it's as if, I mean, you know, somebody came down with a magic wand, and I've had so many wishes granted, and not least children and grandchildren who are just great to get on with. So I'm very reluctant to say, tell you what I really like to do, because I tend not to think about that. It's just a case of, I wonder what's going to happen next. And if nothing else does, you won't catch me complaining. I've been terribly lucky to be interested and to be offered things which I've been, you know, lucky enough to, and think, oh, I'll have a go at that. You know, I have turned down Strictly. I have turned down Damn a Celebrity to Get Me Out of Here. They don't hold any tracks and form.
You've been great on those.
No. Nobody wants to see me picking fluff out of my navel on Damn a Celebrity. And I certainly don't want to be covered in cockroaches, for which I don't have any soft spot at all. I love doing what I do. I like people. And yeah. I like interesting people. And most folk are, if you can find out what they're interested in. And I hope I'm companionable and that reasonable company, but I also am very happy in my own. As a writer, I can sit here and just write, and I can be quiet and silent. I don't need people around me the whole time, though when they are there, I enjoy their company. And I love making television programmes, particularly ones which are live or recorded as live. And I've been blessed. I mean, that's the bottom line, really. And I don't say that in a kind of twee way. It's just to be allowed to do what you enjoy doing, and also to meet people along the way who've spotted what you might be good at that you never thought you would be yourself. Often we don't know what we're capable of. And I've never been one of those people who says, I'm going to do this career plan, bum, 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 because I've always felt, well, it probably wouldn't happen anyway, then it would be disappointing. And what if something happens along the way which I hadn't planned for and I say no to? And I think, let's just see what happens. And so here I am at 71, just waiting to see what happens, really.
Well, I mean, you've been amazing company for me this afternoon. And I think what you've achieved is just remarkable. And you're a bit of a hero of mine. So I'm thrilled that you've been on the podcast. And I think we've got a lot more to come from you. And
you're very kind. I am. You can't see I'm blushing, but I am.
Well, and I hope you have a wonderful family Christmas. Thank you, Alan.
Pleasure, Tamsin. Thank you Thank very you. Much. It's been a pleasure.
A huge thank you to Alan, who I thoroughly enjoyed talking to. He's truly an inspiration. I wish him and you all a peaceful Christmas, and thank you so much for listening to Fresh from the Pod. I've got more great guests planned for 2021. Happy gardening.